Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Search up ABC Pacific Prepared to listen online or find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an ABC podcast.
Tēnā koe, I orana, kam na mauru and good fellow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Now, before we start, we acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Looking at what's on the show today, scammers may have to rethink their tactics following a sweep of raids by Timorese authorities.
What the criminal networks are finding is that the place is no pushover. They had their big, expensive scam centre in Oikussi taken down last year, and now they've had 250 people arrested. I mean, I don't think they have much of a future there.
And some experts warn the industry's economic promises from deep-sea mining may not match reality.
I'm always worried when the message sounds too good to be true. When you start poking holes in it and asking serious questions, people get very defensive. And that to me is always a signal that there's a bit of a scam going on.
And there's calls for stronger policing in central Guadalcanal following a surge of criminal activity.
I'll call upon also the police. If you can come in and help and assist, otherwise this is the beginning of thing and it can trigger the tension between provinces. So.
More on those stories shortly. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and I say mālo apito. Thank you for spending your morning with us here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. First to Timor-Leste, where now more than 250 people have been apprehended following a sweep of raids on alleged scam centres. While details about what the alleged scams are is still unclear, these raids follow on from a major bust last year in the Timorese region of Oikussi, where authorities raided a hotel detaining 30 foreign nationals and seizing phones and Starlink units. The University of Adelaide's Dr. Michael Rose recently visited the site of the Oikussi raid in March this year, and he told reporter Jordan Fennell he's encouraged to see Timor police cracking down on the issue.
I think what these more recent raids show us is probably two things. One is that the connections were pretty extensive. It clearly wasn't just the one operation that was going on. But I guess the second thing is that these raids have happened. 250 people, that's a lot of people in a small country like Timor-Leste. And I think it shows that the sort of security forces there, for all their sort of complexities and struggles over the years, are on top of this issue, or at least across this issue, and willing to make sure that groups like this don't and can't operate with impunity. And I don't know, but I suspect that it may come as sort of a surprise to some of these networks, because we know that they target places which are sort of perceived to have weak governance, to have police forces which might lack the technical capacity to observe what they're doing and then control what they're doing. But clearly in the case of Timor-Leste, that's not really the case. I mean, I think it shows that the international organised crime has sort of identified Timor-Leste as a soft mark, but I think it's, or an easy touch, but I think it also shows that they're underestimated. Sort of Timor-Leste.
Now, there haven't been a great many details come out about exactly what these particular alleged scam centres have been doing in these raids. But what do we know about these particular alleged scam centres, about what they've been doing, who they might have been targeting, and how these operations have likely been sort of financed or controlled?
So I can't speak to the specific ones which were taken down in the past week or so. I can speak with a little more detail about the one which was being run out of Oikussi, and I understand that they run along similar models. I'd also add that I was actually back in Timor, back in Oikussi, sort of having a look at all this firsthand back in March. So I was fortunate enough to be able to sort of speak to a few people with an inside sort of perspective on on what was happening. Essentially, they were doing a few different things. The scam center in Oikussi was, at least, and I understand these are similar. They were sort of running scams, if you will, involving online gaming in a number of different countries. There were calls going out to Brazil from Timorese who speak a bit of Portuguese. They found young people who speak Portuguese and got them to sort of make these phone calls. There were scam calls going out to Malaysia and Indonesia, once again, employing Bahasa-speaking Timorese as well as Indonesians. And there were scam calls going out in English. So it was sort of an international operation involved in dodgy online gaming operations and calling people to sort of, you know, get their numbers to get them involved in that type of thing.
And what do we know about how potential transnational criminal networks could potentially gain a foothold in a country like Timor?
Well, the UN report, UN Office on Crimes and Drugs report that came out sort of last year is the gold standard in describing that. But it very cleverly sort of looked at the different sort of figures involved in setting up these centres and established that it was the same figures who had been involved in running similar centres in Myanmar and Cambodia, and increasingly, I believe, in different parts of the Pacific. So how do they gain a foothold? There's a few different factors. There'd be different networks which organise crime, various sorts of organised crime has a connection with. Some of them would be connected with people in Timor-Leste. What they need then is they need a situation in terms of governance where they have local officials or politicians who can be influenced to look the other way or facilitate them. And certainly there have been direct allegations about this. The interesting thing, I suppose, is despite all of these factors, which you think might make Timor-Leste vulnerable to this sort of operation, what the criminal networks are finding is that the place is no pushover. Like they had their big expensive scam center in Oikussi taken down last year, and now they've had 250 people arrested. So, I don't think they have much of a future there. Let's hope not.
And that's the University of Adelaide's Dr. Michael Rose speaking to reporter Jordan Fennell there. Meanwhile, earlier this week, we ran a story from our reporter in Timor-Leste about the government's plans to expand the airport in the capital in Dili. To do that, developers would need to evict more than 50 families who live on what authorities say is state land. Yesterday, bulldozers and police moved in and began demolishing buildings and properties in the area. Despite the start of eviction, residents have remained steadfast, telling the ABC that they will not be moved from the land they have lived on for many decades.
Our demand to the state is simple. Our rights must be paid just like our neighbours who've already received their compensation. We live in the same area. Why is it that some are being paid while others are not?
We are terrified by this eviction. How can we be expected to leave? Our rights have not been respected and our compensation has not been paid. We cannot leave this place.
And those were just some of the voices of residents in an area that's being redeveloped for the expansion of Dili's International Airport.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges. From how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Me taki ma'ata, thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. Now, the United States says securing access to deep sea minerals in the Cook Islands is a strategic priority as it looks to reduce its reliance on Chinese supply chains. Washington's ambassador to New Zealand, Jared Novelli, who is also responsible for the Cook Islands, Niue and Samoa, says he's keen to connect US companies with opportunities in the sector during an upcoming visit. As Carl Evans reports, while the Cook Islands government is open to investment, some experts warn the industry's economic promises may not match reality.
Very few people on Earth have seen a polymetallic nodule in its natural habitat. but Rob McCallum is one of them.
It's a seafloor with soft sediment, and then dotted all around it are these little lumps that are anywhere between the size of a potato all the way up to maybe a baseball, and they're black.
Rob is the founder of EOS Expeditions, a firm that specialises in deep-sea diving. He's led exhibitions to some of the deepest parts of the world's oceans and has explored the depths of the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, one of the primary targets for prospective deep-sea mining companies.
Because they're so distinctive, they're very easy to see with sonar. They're also very easy to see with the naked eye.
These tiny rocks contain rich concentrations of valuable metals, used for things like batteries, electronics, and energy transition infrastructure. Rob likens them to nuggets from Australia's gold rush era. Small, shiny, seemingly ripe for the taking. But that's also what worries him.
I'm always worried when the message sounds too good to be true, and when you start poking holes in it and asking serious questions, people get very defensive. And that, to me, is always a signal that there's a bit of a scam going on.
While not yet commercially legal, billions have been invested in exploration and research into deep-sea mining, and governments and companies are positioning themselves for what they believe could become a new source of critical minerals. The US and Cook Islands are among them.
It's been a long time since we've had a significant collaboration of this nature with the United States.
We valued showing the Cook Islanders that we're here to help and we're here to partner with them and to put our money where our mouth is.
We're doing this for Cook Islanders, for our people.
Cook Islands waters lie on the southwestern edge of the Clarion-Clipperton Zone and contains rich deposits of polymetallic nodules. Jared Novley, the US ambassador to several Pacific countries, said securing Cook Island seabed minerals was a top priority for Washington, which seeks to reduce its reliance on Chinese supply chains. The Cook Islands, meanwhile, could stand to gain much from royalties and mining fees if the industry does get the green light. But some share Rob's fear that this exciting and emerging industry might be nothing more than fool's gold built on unrealistic promises and irrational optimism.
I think that people will see a picture of, you know, the Clarion-Clipperton Zone and see all these nodules sitting on the bottom of the seafloor, and the picture doesn't give justice to the actual environment, and therefore they think it's easy.
Victor Vescovo is an American venture capitalist. He has a background in metals processing and has piloted deep-sea submersibles and spent 20 years in the Navy. He said because the deep-sea mining industry is so unknown, very few experts actually exist. As a result, debates can become overly simplistic, and the very real technical challenges get overlooked or glossed over.
So then the industry will say, well, you know, we've been doing, you know, deep ocean oil drilling and you know, for decades, so we know how to operate in the deep ocean. They're different. They're different because oil is under thousands of PSI. It wants to come up. It's a liquid. Also, the typical average offshore oil well is maybe, let's call a weighted average like 1,000 meters. We're talking 4,000 minimum to do deep ocean nodule mining.
Unlike oil or gas, polymetallic nodules can't simply be pumped from beneath the seabed. They have to be physically gathered from the ocean floor by robotic collective vehicles before being transported to the surface through a riser system. No production scale vehicle exists yet, although industry leader The Metals Company successfully tested a prototype in 2022. It managed to recover 3,000 tonnes of nodules, but Victor said it was only a fraction of what would be required for a commercial operation.
Having multi-ton vehicles to get the rocks is making an environment that is the most hostile you could imagine for a machine. And if it breaks, or it falls into a micro ditch or anything, it's 4,000 to 5,000 meters below the ship that can support it. There's no human there. They've got to bring it all the way back up.
Perhaps most concerning, though, is the economic case underpinning the industry, which Victor says no longer stacks up. Two of the four key metals found in polymetallic nodules, nickel and cobalt, were once considered central to the electric vehicle revolution. But he says that's no longer the case.
In the last 7 years, there has been a dramatic shift in the technology. More than 50% of vehicle batteries, including the ones in Australia, are lithium iron phosphate. They use no nickel and no cobalt.
Chris Fleming, a professor of economics for the Griffith University Business School, agrees, saying it's no longer clear if deep-sea mining is needed for the electrification of cars.
Some of the big potential players have already ruled out using deep-sea minerals. They're also working pretty hard to try and get sodium-based batteries up and running, so based on salt, right? a lot cheaper, a lot easier to find. And so if that is the way of the future, then we could actually see the demand for those minerals fall off a cliff pretty quickly.
So what does it all mean for Pacific nations like the Cook Islands? Well, if the industry does manage to get up and running, Professor Fleming says any revenue they make will depend on their ability to negotiate royalties.
The reality is that industry won't employ a lot of Cook Islanders. Most of the skills, or a lot of the skills, will be fly in, fly out, just because of the level of technicality needed. And likely that even once they've harvested off the seafloor, the processing will happen somewhere else.
Victor says Pacific states could gain a lot financially from deep sea mining. However, it comes with the risk of environmental damage to the seafloor. Rob, meanwhile, says much like the gold rush era in the 1800s, the money will only flow to one place.
When you actually look at the cold, hard economics of what will be recovered, how much of it will be recovered, and what will it sell for, very quickly you expose that this is not a get-rich-quick scheme. Yeah, again, I use the analogy of a gold rush, where everybody thought they were going to get rich quick. People dropped tools and ran to get to the gold field and get in there early. Most of the people that did well were the people who were supplying the hardware or the services that supported the mining effort. And I think deep sea mining will be the same.
And that is Rob McCullum, deep sea explorer and founder of EOS Expeditions, ending that report from Carl Evans. And just to note, US Ambassador Novelli was unavailable for comment when approached by the ABC. Meanwhile, the Cook Islands government did not respond to our request for an interview, but we are hoping to have a response from the Metals Company for tomorrow's program. All right, to the Solomon Islands, where there are calls for stronger policing in central Guadalcanal following a surge of criminal activity. Communities there have experienced attacks on homes and businesses, and a logging truck was torched by masked men. The MP for central Guadalcanal, Peter Chanel Agavoca, has called for visible policing in the area. Simri Luani is a tribal leader, and he says the attacks have left women and children traumatised. He told the ABC's Sam Siki it could lead to another ethnic conflict unless it is contained.
From my community, Pilar Central Guadalcanal, we have experienced little bit tense, and people, community, children and women live in fears, and there are groups. Recently there was a group of thieves with arms. They come into the community and break into some of our houses and stole some properties and monies. And so from me and on behalf of my people, it's not acceptable, and it's something that I should call upon every leaders to come out and help in sorting out this one. The moment we try to find out some related issues with people outside, maybe from Malaita, or the suspect, they are the ones who are coming in. But yet we are still finding and not come out clearly with any issue with them. So we regard this group as a pure thief group, and we call upon the leaders from the other side, the Laitans groups, or whoever responsible to this group, to please, can you call your people back? And if there is any issue, you come through the leaders from the other side and come to our chiefs and community leaders, and we'll see how we can sort out this.
So what is your biggest worry here as a community and tribal leader in central Guadalcanal?
I think the experience now, we don't want to live into this experience anymore. So I'll call upon also the police. If you can come in and play whatever parts you can play in this incident, help and assist. We want to experience another ethnic tension. Otherwise, this is the beginning of, like the previous tension, this is likely the beginning, and it can trigger some tension between provinces or We don't know. But I'd like to put a full stop here, call upon every leaders to come out and help each other. We don't want to experience Guadalcanal with bad relations with other province. I call upon every leader to come and amicably try to sort out this issue. Thank you, Seke.
So these outsiders coming into your community, were they just thieves stealing, or what else did they do?
What we have seen here is that they have armed with knives and some other weapons, wearing masks, and come in and break into houses. But what is seen here is that they come in for steal, just to break in. And but if there is any reaction from the community, maybe, you know, they can go into killing, or I don't know, but likely, because they come with arms. But because of, you know, the women's and the community people, we don't react. We don't, you know, react. So maybe they can just come and steal, just come and get the properties and go out.
And that there is Simri Luani, community and tribal leader in central Guadalcanal. He was speaking there to ABC's Sam Seki. All right, tuberculosis remains a major health challenge in Papua New Guinea, particularly in Western Province, where drug-resistant strains of the disease have been circulating for years. A major screening project in Daru has now tested nearly 19,000 people, more than 80% of the island's population. Researchers say they've uncovered hundreds of cases of active TB, with many of those diagnosed reporting no symptoms when they were first screened. So joining us this morning is the Burnett Institute's sweep program, Dr. Ayung Ayung. He joins us on the line from Daru. With that, I say good morning, Dr. Ayung, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Doctor, can you just firstly maybe tell us what has been the impact of TB on PNG?
Well, the impact of TB and the PNG is quite huge, especially in the Western Province, and where I work in Daru, which, as you said earlier, there is an immediate TB outbreak in the past that has led to all these challenges. And then now it's end up with our community screening, which is called SWEEP TB, in the last 2 years.
Mm. But before this project, though, Doctor, what were you seeing in terms of numbers? Like, how many people were actually affected by TB?
The number of patients affected every year is quite significant. Let's say like 600 to 700 every year in that area. But it's not only about the number; it's about like a magnitude impact on the population here. So it is quite big compared to the other national prevalence as well as other countries.
Mm. Doctor, you talk about the program that you're part of, which is the SWEEP TB. What exactly is that? And how has this project, I suppose, been any different from maybe other approaches?
Okay, so SWEEP TB is actually, we want to screen, treat and prevent the whole population in Daru Islands. So we want to integrate this TB care into the community, find the cases as early as they came before they are getting sick to come to the health center for the further care. So we also want to build a local community capacity building, health workforce, diagnosis system, referral linkage. So that is the main aims of the SWEEP TB. And that is actually not quite very different than other settings. That is what WHO has recommended for community screening for the high burden setting. So that's what we have implemented in Daru Islands.
Mm. Can you take us through how that testing looks like when you are screening your clients there?
Okay, so we try to reach every single people on the island. So that is why we use like community engagement, and we use house-to-house screening, and we also utilize x-rays and also like a rapid diagnosis test. So on a normal day, like we started with community engagement with our team and also community leaders and the members, and then we distribute the message, and the team goes house-to-house, door-to-door, And we do the symptomatic screening in the house, give it some educations. And then they are referred to a sort of central location close to their houses for the further checkup, like x-ray examination. And also if they are symptomatic or they are have some they are presumptive, we collect a sputum. And then after that, the result come back, either they are at TTP or not. So this is a process that we normally do in a normal day.
Doctor, so it's very much a community approach. I can see you're going door to door. What has been the response then from the community? Because, you know, sometimes maybe stigma plays a big factor into people coming forward, right? Is that the case sometimes?
Well, I think people have different ideas and then they have their own concept in that things. So we also have experience with community engagement. So we understand what people will think of. So that's why we strategize our community engagement messages that TB is the thing that we are coming to help them. We're coming to help to screen if they have heavy disease, we can treat them and we can prevent them. So that is what we also strategize ourselves, our community engagement strategy to reach to the people, to reduce the stigma, to make them aware, to understand the disease.
Nice. Now, with those who have been diagnosed with TB, I understand some actually had no symptoms at all. So I'm wondering, how critical is this in terms of stopping transmission?
Well, I think this is the biggest thing that we found out. So we have like more than half of the total active cases that we found are not showing any symptoms. This is quite significant because it is, if we rely on the people who are sick and who came to the health facilities for the care, that will be too late, and that will be like they will be transmitted the disease in the community. So that this is the main point that we have to we found out, and then we have helped them discover those hidden cases to get the treatment as early as possible.
Doctor, for those who are listening in, I'm sure they would like to know, though, what are the symptoms that families should actually look for when should they actually seek testing?
Oh, the non-usual TB symptoms are like cough, fever, night sweat, weight loss, and they are having like hemoptysis, sort of like a coughing up the blood. So that is the usual TB symptom we used to rely on. And that's why we also utilize it. But at the same time, like as I said earlier, like more than half of the people that we have diagnosed do not report any of these symptoms. We only discover through the chest x-rays. So it is not only that we have to rely on the symptoms are developing at the stage, which is already maybe late. So whenever there is a contact of TB, whenever there is someone in your household with the TB, we have to diagnose, we have to screen for the whole the whole household. So something like that. So of course symptoms are there, but we should not wait for the symptom for the until very late. And we have to have like a sort of a like community-wide screening to know the prevalence since earlier.
And how has the approach been? Like, what are the results that you've been seeing so far?
So we know that initially it was quite a normal text that we know that, but we understand at the end that like, it is possible and feasible to do the community screening in such kind of resource limited setting like in Daru, and we have achieved a high uptake of screening, and then we have found like hundreds of TB cases during this the screening. So at the end, this is a significant achievement, and this is something that we proved that it's possible to do in such kind of community in Daru.
Nice to hear. Okay, well, Doctor, really, could this community-wide approach that you're doing with the Sweep TB become maybe a model for the rest of the Pacific?
We are trying to do these things in this community because the TB is high and it's a challenge. And then we also knew that this is feasible, impossible to do it in such kind of community. So that could be a model that we can further spread, not only in PNG and Dari Western Province, but also other settings which is applicable to. At the same time, like we can also understand the context in the different locations and then modify a bit to expand this activity to other places. Mm. We also require like continual investment for the further screening.
Beautiful. Well, some great work that you are doing there, Doctor, and really appreciate that you've been able to come on the show and share about the Sweep TB. Again, we just want to say thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having a chance to speak about that, and thank you.
Appreciate it. That is Burnett Institute Tuberculosis Specialist Dr. Ayung Ayung here on Pacific Beat.
Wherever you're listening, from Timor to Tonga, ABC Radio Australia is yours in the Pacific, yours for news.
Me taki ma'ata and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Fiji and Palau, they've put their hands up to host a major Pacific climate meeting.
Yours for sport.
Welcome everyone to Nijin Footy, the best place for Pacifica footy news and stories in the rugby league and rugby union world.
Yours for music.
Your and Sister Sounds are heading from Fiji to Aotearoa for something a little bit different, to an artist called Ma. She's got such a unique style, singing in her Maori tongue.
Yours for Pacific stories.
Lafi Moala, welcome to Stories from the Pacific. Now, what made you decide to create Times of Tonga?
It was a time that I need to make a contribution to my country.
And yours for celebrating Pacific culture.
Niji Daily producer took a trip to the Te Papata Arts Centre.
Skilled artisans creating traditional Samoan objects out of material.
Wherever you are, ABC Radio Australia is yours in the Pacific.
Malo Apito and welcome back to Pacific Beat. We go to sport now, where after the London Broncos star trio of Kumuls, Moria Moria, Finlay Glele and Gairo Vono landed development contracts with the PNG Chiefs, there was much debate over what those contracts signified. Well, the Broncos and Kumuls head coach Jason Demetrio has cleared the air, saying that the way is open for all three players to be in the Chiefs' starting lineup from day one when the club enters the NRL in 2028. However, as Richard Hewitt reports, there could be a fly in the ointment if the all-conquering Broncos are not granted a place at the top table in the English Super League next season.
Check out the YouTube comments on the live stream when the Broncos matches are beamed into PNG and the fans are in no doubt the team has to be in Super League next season. With the aid of their three Kumuls now on the Chiefs' books, the London team is dominating England's second-tier championship with a series of crushing victories.
Glare finds a hole and he's on his way through. Up over the halfway line, Finlay Glare wants some of the action. Nice pass. Savoro is going in for try number 6 of the afternoon. Lovely little back pass from Finlay Glare. Finding Voro. Glare bursts his way through. Finds Voro, does he? Yes, he does. Voro in for number 7. Finlay Glare with the offloads, finding Gairo Vono.
The individual performances of Glare, Vono and Morea have seen them signed up by the Chiefs on two-year development deals. But speaking to the Post Courier Online, their coach Jason Demetrio says don't be misled by the name.
It's basically to do with the salary cap. So you have a top 30 roster and then you have 6 players that you can sign on a development contract. Now, what that means in terms of playing first grade, it means nothing. Anyone in that top 36 can play first grade. The money for the development contract sits outside the initial top 30 cap. So there's a second tier cap, which the boys will be on, but they changed the rules a few years ago. If you're on development contract, you couldn't play until round 12. That's all gone now. You can play as early as round 1.
However, the Chiefs management want the three PNG boys put to the test in 2027. And if the Broncos are not in Super League, there is talk of them being recalled to play for the PNG Hunters in Australia. But Demetriou has spent months developing the players in England and he believes the London environment is more than capable of preparing them for the rigours of the NRL, whether the Broncos are promoted or not.
It still is a huge thing to come over here. I remember talking to Gairo after we played Fiji. I was literally about to get on the plane and go back to Australia before coming over to England. And I asked Gairo if he was interested in coming and he nodded his head and didn't say much, as he doesn't often, but within days he was signed and on a plane, and so it all happened pretty quickly, which just shows how committed the boys are to their craft. And everyone here, all the supporters, everybody at the club loves having them here.
The Broncos co-owner and former captain of the Australian Kangaroos, Darren Lockyer, says after securing a monster TV rights deal, the NRL could hold the key to the club's future pathway in the RFL.
I think the AFL needs to understand that there's a lot of teams, whether they're in the Super League or they're not, like us, that are in limbo about what's happening next year. The NRL, they've got their TV broadcast deal done, and I'm quite certain that the NRL has a desire to invest in the Super League and help the Northern Hemisphere.
So in a perfect world, we're in Super League next year, the NRL is involved, their expertise, their capital, and it just supercharges the game in the Northern Hemisphere, which is a great outcome for the game. But if that's not to be, then we just have to work with the cards we've been dealt.
And Lockyer says the Broncos could find out quite soon which cards they will have in their hand.
For the next probably 2 weeks, you're going to know more. You can see our intent. We want to be in Super League. We're making signings. We're winning well in the championship. But it's up to the RFL if they want to allow the NRL to invest.
But regardless of how things play out with the Broncos, Jason Demetriou is in no doubt that the three PNG Musketeers will fit right in with the Chiefs and continue to flourish in England in the meantime.
The good thing about what the boys have done is sign a two-year deal. So they've got time to develop, get used to the systems and the processes, get used to their teammates without the pressure of having to hit the ground running in year one, which is going to be intense for not only these boys, but everybody who's in the Chiefs system, getting used to living together, training together, being part of a community 24/7 every day of the week. It's going to be a challenge, but I've seen from what these guys have done over here that they'll adapt comfortably to that.
And that is Jason Demetriou, head coach of the London Broncos and the PNG Cornwalls, ending that report from Richard Hewitt. Up next, it's your news wrap. Yes, welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time where we head around the region to get some headlines from across the Pacific, and brought to us by our producer, Fina Funua, who's in the studio with me this morning. Fefe.
So we're again.
Good, okay. Well, look, there's a lot happening at the moment, not just, of course, with the FIFA World Cup semi-finals, but we want to get around to this story here. A week after a Chinese missile test sparked protests across the Pacific, Beijing has reaffirmed its commitment to maintaining positive diplomatic relations with Solomon Islands. What's the latest?
Yes, according to the South China Morning Post, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi met Solomon Islands Foreign Minister Rick Hoeniwela in Beijing on Tuesday. This was just days after China test-fired a ballistic missile from a nuclear-powered submarine on July 6. In a statement released following that meeting, Mr. Wang Yi pledged to deepen exchanges at all levels and expand cooperation relating to green energy, climate change, education, and other fields. He said, quote, China maintains continuity and stability in its policy towards the Solomon Islands and has always supported the Solomon Islands in safeguarding its national sovereignty. He says that Beijing doesn't impose its will on others, but a lot of controversy, of course. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Matthew Wallet not happy with China following that ballistic missile test. And he pledged to reveal China's pact as a result of that. So it looks like damage control for Beijing at the moment.
Yeah, at the moment, definitely. Still a lot to unpack on that. Okay, let's head to Hawaiian. UFC fighter has defeated Conor McGregor. My goodness, what happened here?
Oh, yes. Iconic MMA fighter Conor McGregor, an Irishman, was seeking to return back to the octagon to try and revive his career. But it didn't last long. 69 seconds wow. into the fight, Max Holloway, native Hawaiian, defeated him. McGregor suffered a knee injury.
Goodness.
And funny thing is, Max Holloway said there needed to be a rematch because he didn't get to beat up McGregor.
That's the point of a fight, isn't it?
Yes, Holloway also of Samoan heritage, and his entrance into the octagon was to Hawaiian music, which
wow.
seemed unusual compared to the usual walkout,
yes.
which is metal or some hype up music.
Did you get to actually watch it? How what was the game like though? Watching, I mean, it was only 69 seconds.
It was disappointing because we didn't get to see the Hawaiian beat up.
Yes.
McGregor.
Goodness. But look, hey, congratulations, of course, to Holloway. I know many Holloways. So well done to Max for literally taking out one of the greats, right? Because McGregor has been around for a while.
Yes, yes. Yeah, an iconic fighter and and a big sports personality as well.
Interesting. Okay, well, look, we head to the US. They've dispatched a nuclear tech submarine to Guam. What's happened here?
Yes, interesting movement here. According to military.com, the U.S. Navy has permanently relocated a nuclear-powered attack submarine from its original home base in Pearl Harbor to now to Guam. And this occurs just days after the ballistic missile test from China. So, yeah, it raises
timing is pretty off.
You think it's a bit coincidental. But it's a nuclear-powered submarine, one of the biggest in the U.S. Pacific fleet. So, interesting to see why that's occurred.
Yeah, okay. Well, we will keep our eyes and ears on that story too. But for sure, thank you very much, Fina, for always coming through and giving us our headlines from around the region. And that is your news wrap here on Pacific Beat. Well, the FIFA World Cup has reached the pointy end, with four teams left to battle it out for a spot in the final. The first of the semi-finals is taking place right now, with France facing European rivals Spain. In Vanuatu, though, the World Cup is serious business. We understand a street parade was held at the start of the tournament in Port Vila, and it's evident from the flags that France are the fan favourites in Vanuatu. Well, we're crossing now to our reporter in the capital, Port Vila, Lily Rose Wellwell. How are you doing this morning, Lily Rose?
I'm good yourself?
I'm doing well. I've got the game in front of me, but I know that there's a lot happening there. Where are you now? Like, what's the atmosphere there like?
So early in the morning, I was with the French supporters. It was electric in the morning. Then after the two goals, it was the 2 points that were scored by Spain, the atmosphere was not a bit too happy, but I'm now with the Spain supporters. They're drinking cava, they're very happy. So they had breakfast and everybody with smiles.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Looking at the scoreboard now, it does look like France may be or about to suffer a shock loss to Spain. Again, what's the reaction been on the ground from both sides, from both supporters?
Well, for France, it was a bit disappointing after the second call. But for the Spain supporters, they're very happy. You can hear them at the background shouting just so that the defensive when the ball is on their side. So everybody's just like standing and just watching and waiting for the 90 minutes and whatever extra time that the referee will give.
Yeah. And again, I mentioned in the beginning that there was a street parade, right, at the start of the tournament. Wondering, though, whether or not that early buzz is going to translate into just ongoing support for France. What do you think?
Well, it will be, because they have a camp that was set up. So at the start of the World Cup with the parade, what stood out was the group's commitment that hasn't been about. Of course, it's about winning, but they turn up for the matches throughout the tournament. Other teams including those that have lost the matches. So the group has grown, but now it'll be up to other teams that they will be supporting, including Spain, and getting ready for the quarterfinals. So I think the commitment is still there for them to come together, have love, drink some tea, cover, of course, and support the team.
Lily Rose, why do you think Le Bleu captured so much local support in Vanuatu, I suppose, maybe compared to the other semi-finalists?
Well, to help understand the connection, Vanuatu is a proudly independent nation with a unique story of its own. We speak English, French, and our own, like Bislama, the legacy of our history that's become part of who we are. Many people went through French medium schools. Some have studied in France, and a few families are Anglophone and Francophone both. So it is also through marriages. So quite a lot of people supporting France. He's just not about football. It's also personal. So, but another thing that people love is also it's exciting to watch their attacking style of play. Unfortunately, this morning that didn't play out to their benefit.
Well, Lily Rose, unless the Le Bleus pull off a remarkable comeback in the final minutes of this match, it will be Spain in the final of the World Cup. Now, we know the opponents will either be England or Argentina. Out of these three teams, Spain, England and Argentina, who would you say are the fan favourites in Vanuatu?
The fan favourite, France, of course. But then when you look at the number of people that have gathered here, Spain has that much number of less than the French supporters, but it will be France and Argentina. If the call stands now, that'll probably be Spain and Argentina or England, whoever is qualified to go to the final. But a lot of supporters are French supporters and Argentina, the one out of the four.
Now, could you maybe talk about the popularity of the Football World Cup in Vanuatu? Because I understand the World Cup is one of the biggest events for Vanuatu, right?
The World Cup, everybody goes to work late. Students, when they woke up this morning to watch us to watch soccer, all of them are still in their uniforms now, probably going to school at around 8. So it's a big thing here in Vanuatu. So every time there's a World Cup, everybody, we know for the period of how many months it is or the weeks, there's not going to be a lot of activities happening, a lot of banter going on social media back and forth. But mostly it's a time where people come together because of the love of a particular team and to support their teams going forward. And, of course, drinking kava.
And I know we've seen a lot of funny social media videos from Vanuatu supporting their teams. You have to tell us about that.
Yeah, so a lot of people are going back and forth with it's a time for them to celebrate soccer. So there's a post about, you know, just cheeky banter online about their teams winning or just being cheeky. But there's a lot of support from the teams. Some are taking it serious. Some are taking are just doing it for the fun of the sport. And if your team loses, it's more, they're like more than welcome to welcome you to the team. Of course, there'll be some butter back and forth, but at the end of the day, the love for the sport is what's most evident during this World Cup period. Yeah.
I do have to ask before I let you go, Lily Rose, who are you supporting?
No, my team already lost, so now I'm just enjoying watching people. So it's good just to support other teams and just watching people support other teams and support football, that's all.
Awesome. Well, look, Lily Rose, great to catch up with you. I do know right now at the moment Spain is leading 2-0 to France. So obviously we'll see what happens in the dying minutes. But again, just want to say thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Aki.
No worries. That is our reporter, Lily Rose Wellwell, in Port Vila, here on Pacific Beat.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
Dipsosaurus dorsalis. All right, that's the word for the day. Apparently, it's the name for these iguanas, Michael Chow.
They're very green, too. Look them up there. They're very green, Jacob.
She was not kidding.
Greener than Kermit.
Yeah, what a hue.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. In Timor-Leste, more than 250 people have been apprehended following a sweep of raids on alleged scam centres.
What the criminal networks are finding is that the place is no pushover. They had their big, expensive scam centre in Oikussi taken down last year, and now they've had 250 people arrested. I mean, I don't think they have much of a future there.
Now, you can find those top stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. And please check us out on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because your news is up next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tua o fatu, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.